Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts. In this week's episode, non-resident fellow Hope Along Botokwane speaks to political analyst and media expert Dr. Meji Makoba about the domestic implications of South Africa's recent case against Israel at The Hague and the country's upcoming elections in which the ruling African National Congress is expected to lose its majority. Dr. Makoba holds a PhD in journalism from Cardiff University, where he was a Commonwealth Scholar. Now he teaches communication at the University of Limpopo in South Africa. Before we get to their conversation, I want to pause and recognize the exciting election and really democracy news coming out of Senegal this week after it held its elections on Sunday, March 24th. As my co-host Rachel Beatty-Riedel discussed with guests Bamba Njai and Michelle Gavin in episode 191, Senegalese President Macky Sall had postponed the presidential elections that were originally scheduled for February 25th. The delay was part of a series of concerning moves by Sall to extend his stay in power and to challenge, really, democracy in Senegal. Now, the election results are expected to be confirmed by the Constitutional Council in the coming days. According to a count of provisional votes from 100% of polling stations, opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye won more than 54% of votes in Senegal's presidential election. Now, with Faye having won a majority of the vote, that means that there's not need for a runoff election. If you want to learn more about Senegal's incoming president-elect, who's only 44 years old, we encourage you to read the profile on him in the Financial Times. For our basic primer on elections and politics in Senegal, we also recommend an explainer that's published on the University of Florida's Trans-Saharan Election Project's website. Links to these resources will be posted on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. And in the next few weeks, we'll be featuring an episode putting the Senegalese elections into a broader context. This episode will be in French and produced by non-resident fellow Expedi Ologu, who is currently serving as an ECOWAS election observer in Senegal. Now let's shift our focus to South Africa, which will be holding elections later this year. Let's hear Hope Along's conversation with Dr. Makoba.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about African life and politics. I'm Hope Along Botokwane. South Africa's historic case at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, in which it charged Israel with violating the Genocide Convention, is arguably one of the most important stories of our time, and much has been written about it. But even as it continues to occupy global headlines, there are still questions we are yet to ask. Yes, the world as we know it is gone. Gaza lies in ruins. But what does it mean for a continent so often defined by conflict and human rights violation to try and be the conscience of the world? On this episode, we are going to try and consider what might be the domestic implications or socio-political possibilities of this case. How does taking Israel to court raise the stakes for South Africa and the continent? For South Africa, Gaza has become intertwined with moral redemption. Before the case, there was a feeling that South Africa's moral barometer was running low. This is a country widely considered to be the most unequal place on earth, and the needle on that inequality is yet to move. The administration of former President Jacob Zuma, which enabled the corrupt disruption of the state, was a particular sticking point for many. The post-1994 democratic glow that came with the election of Nelson Mandela was now gone, and South Africa was just another African country defined by corruption and destined for failure. On other fronts, the country is besieged by multiple socio-economic crises, from gender-based violence to xenophobia. And critics of the country have been quick to point these crises out. Many of us on the left believe that by taking Israel to the International Court of Justice, South Africa has not only recharged its moral barometer, but has set a new standard for itself and the continent. Reacting to the case, political analyst Ibrahim Fakir writes that whatever happens at The Hague, South Africa has both changed itself and the world. Even though it's not a superpower or an economic powerhouse, it has earned itself legitimacy, leverage, and influence for at least another decade. But what does it mean for ordinary South Africans when their country fails to hold itself to the standard it imposes on others? On its border, South Africa plays a helpless nanny while its neighbors disregard human rights. Countries like the Kingdom of Eswatini, where the king holds absolute power, continue to enjoy support from Pretoria despite documented human rights abuses. In the New York Times publisher and media scholar Sean Jacobs writes of the case as something that gave the country a glimpse of old hopes. I'm interested in this case, which could be argued wouldn't have been possible if the ruling African National Congress wasn't in power, and what it means in the context of the upcoming elections and ordinary South African lives. Opponents of the ruling party have dismissed the case as an election gimmick, and true to form, ruling party officials have already begun campaigning using the case as an example of the moralism of the party. But can the country genuinely build on it? Dr. Meji Makgoba is a political analyst, a media expert, and I asked him to help us make sense of the implications, not only of the case against Israel, but some of South Africa's recent foreign policy moves. But first, a bit of context. On paper, South Africa is a failing state. It's a country defined by high unemployment and crime. And while the ruling African National Congress has a history of supporting the Palestinian cause, many South Africans were curious about their government's decision and what it meant for ordinary South African lives. South Africa is often accused of convenient or selective moralism, but for political experts like Makgoba, taking Israel to court was inevitable.
So I wanted to ask you about, Israel, South Africa taking Israel to court, right? Were you surprised by that? I mean, a lot of people would say they weren't surprised, right? But for me, I was a bit surprised considering sort of everything we have or everything the country is going through. So I don't know if you were sort of surprised yourself, you know?
No, I don't think it was a surprising move for two things. Firstly, South Africa has been consistent with its criticism of Israel invasion of Palestine, and they were at the forefront of the diplomatic charge against Israel. So it showed that had they found any avenue to take on Israel, they were going to use it. Secondly, there is this historical relations between South Africa and Palestine. They've always been allies. So South Africa saw this as an opportunity to support their friends. At another level, given that South Africa relies on the US or Europe generally on certain trade issues, some people thought they're just going to play like a quiet role. But they have actually rose above and took a very important position in the international community.
What the ruling party has struggled to do is to capitalize or convert taking Israel to court into a public relations victory with electoral implications. While many South Africans were genuinely impressed by their government's stance, the domestic failures of the ruling party are simply too great to grant it electoral grace.
So the criticism of Israel, or the most consistent at least that I hear, is that for some people they see it as a election gimmick, and I wonder if you think that's a fair sort of criticism, right? That it's an election gimmick.
I don't think so, because even before the campaign mood, the launch of manifestos had started, Naledi Pandor has been charging against Israel, and the reasons have been consistent that this is a historical matter. Israel has been occupying Palestine for the past 70 years, so they say, and this has been what South Africa has been all about since the war erupted. And I don't think there's any election gimmicks. I think South Africa has been genuine with the issue, considering the historical relations they have with Palestine.
On the 29th of May, South Africans will vote in the most important elections since the dawn of democracy in 1994. The conflict in Gaza comes as the ruling party prepares to hold its ground in a fiercely contested election where it is widely expected to lose its majority.
But then again, there's the question of whether it has any sort of implication on the elections, considering that we are going to elections and the politicians themselves are sort of politicking on it, although I'll say that they are doing it badly, but they are politicking on it anyway. I mean, I think it's the Justice Minister, Ronald Ramola, I think a few days after returning from the Netherlands, was already on a campaign trail, I guess explaining why they did what they did. And some people would say, yes, you know, we have historic sort of relations and we've supported Palestine since Mandela, etc. But we cannot overlook the fact that there is an election and somehow ANC might want to use the move or benefit from it.
Of course, but it's not going to work. It's not going to work. South Africa is a country with poor people. If you are going to try to sell them a presidential candidate or a party based on that small issue in foreign policy, it's not going to make sense to them. I think for many people, their support of Israel, I mean of Palestine, it's more superficial, really. So it's not something that you can sell to many South Africans that are thinking about the lack of houses, lack of sanitation, lack of roads, bad infrastructure. I think if you're going to kind of use the South Africa's support of Palestine to get election, I mean to gain votes, it's not going to work. It's not going to make any political sense because South Africa has a lot of its own problems. So, and although they have to play some role in the international community, locals would not even see any value in that because they don't see that the connection between our support of Palestine and their existential crisis in South Africa.
But even if the ANC was able to translate the meaning and value of taking Israel to court, the class and racial dynamics of the country would make it impossible for it to matter. That is simply because the majority of the country's citizens are on what some economists have described as survival mode. They are simply trying to get on with life. But that failure also speaks to the stark divisions within the country. Class and race continue to determine which issues become prominent in the national discourse.
So for me, I mean, we do agree that the Israel Gaza issue is insignificant. Not that people don't care, but because South Africa is going through its own issues and the majority of its population
definitely
are on what we might call survival mode. But still, I want to ask. I get the poverty part, the struggling or inequality part. But I think even if the majority of the country cared, the ANC seems to, I don't know, they struggle. I mean, I listen to what Lamola and everyone is saying, and they seems to, there's a failure to translate. I don't even think people don't care. It seems as if there's a failure to translate the importance of that move. And I don't know why. Is it because, you know, the ANC has done so poorly with people that even if there's legitimacy to some of their issues, people just don't take them seriously? Like, I just wonder why they're struggling beyond the inequality. Is it just that the ANC is bad at it?
I think it's just a difficult issue, given that beyond the fact that Palestinians and South Africans only shared some similarities and relations because they were oppressed in some way or another, occupied by another power. I think that's our only similarities. Culturally and beyond, we don't have any similarities. And the relationship is only based on that PLO also supported South Africa during the struggle for against apartheid. And I think that's where it ends. The relationship has been political to that level, but it has not ended some sort of cultural relations between the two countries. And I think for somebody in the Lamola's caliber to translate that message to us, it's not really going to make sense. I think majority of South Africans at the moment would want to understand the history of struggle, but they are also disgruntled that now this history has been appropriated to benefit a small section of the South African black elite, which is in cahoot with white capital. And I think that has been the issue, that the South Africa's move was classist on that base, that we have our own issues here, but you guys are spending money on taking Israel to court for what they are doing in Gaza. And I think because of those dynamics, the message then now starts to have multi-layers. For the South African middle class, that's a good decision because they can relate with the relationship between South Africa and Palestine at that political level and the historical significance of it thereof. But equally, for people that are so poor in South Africa, that do not see friendship in Palestine as warranting such attention, they are not going to see the significance in that sort of arrangement. So South Africa is actually, it shows how South Africa is such a divided society where the citizen cannot agree on a single issue.
Nationalism, which often finds expression as xenophobia in South Africa, is another straw in the cup. It has become a defining feature of some of the country's urban communities. After all, it's in urban areas where South Africa's fierce competition for opportunities and economic resources plays out. Xenophobia is a contradiction to the ruling party's proud Pan-Africanist history and traditions, which in the earlier years of democracy the party tried to honor. But as more and more South Africans anchor their problems on nationalism, or what some politicians have called the absence of patriotism, it's not hard to see why some might struggle to relate to what is happening in Gaza.
So I wanted to ask you, because you do speak of these divisions within the country. How much of nationalism? There seems to be a nationalism, and we'll talk a bit about migration as well. But there seems to be this, unless I'm wrong, I don't know, but there seems to be a growing sense of this intense nationalism, right? And I wonder how much of that has to do with a lack of interest, right? We do say that South Africa is one of the most unequal countries in the world. People are struggling. But I'm interested in whether we see this ethno or this nationalism, right? This intense nationalistic feelings. And I'm curious as to whether it has something to do with it. It might somehow affect how people respond to that. Because it seems as if more and more South Africans are saying us first. There's an us first, a nationalism or nationalistic feeling. I don't know if you've noticed that. And obviously we will talk a bit about migration as well, because much of it has to do with migration. But I'm just curious as to, there's also just the issue that it's not an African issue, and we are just not going to touch it, or a South African issue, if there's an element of that as well in the response to the case.
I think it's a common issue in the world, actually. I can't even say Africa, in the world, that people are so proud of their own countries, even though they cannot point to the material benefit of being connected to that country. And I think that's where the ideology of patriotism and nationalism works, in order to persuade people to attach meaning to something that is more like the rainbow. You see it there, but when you go near, the rainbow is not, it's not there. And I think that's how patriotism in South Africa has been functioning, that people feel a sense of belonging, but that sense of belonging does not translate into tangible benefits that are going to uplift their own living conditions. And I think that's what we've seen with the Springboks. They've kind of united the country, as people said during their World Cup victory. But how can a white team that is dominated by white supremacy and white supremacist traditions be a unifying symbol for South Africans in totality, where South African, Black South Africans, especially Africans, find themselves as a cultural minority in a country where they're a numeric majority. So this nationalism or patriotism, it's empty and it's not aligned to people's material belonging. It's something that is ideologically manufactured, that's to control people's minds and hearts.
But perhaps modern nationalism is the neo-colonial nature of South Africa that ties it to conflict and issues that might not always warrant immediate interest. The recent deployment of 3,000 troops in the DRC, or Democratic Republic of Congo, is one such example. A lot has been said about this being a mission to protect lives. Congo is a minerally rich country, and there are analysts who suggest that if one followed the possible benefits for a country deploying troops in that region, you might get a different picture. More so when the men and women who are deployed are poorly trained and ill-equipped.
South Africa is a neo-colonial, in Africa at least, right? South Africa is a neo-colonial power. I mean, there are South African companies all over Africa, right? I remember I had a journalist friend of mine was saying, sometimes there'll be white South Africans in other African countries, and you wouldn't know that they are from South Africa, right? And South Africa is a neo-colonial power. Is that a fair thing to say? There's this neo-colonialism that informs some of its foreign policy decisions? Because I want to link that to the recent deployment of the South African National Defense Force in Congo, right? It is clear. Oh, well, that's what most South Africans will tell you if you ask them on the street, that South Africa has no capacity whatsoever to be deployed, right? It doesn't even have capacity to sort of protect its own citizens by the numbers at least. The statistics tell us that South African state has no monopoly on violence, basically. Even Zimbabwe, at some point, people argue that a Zimbabwe that is considered a failed state seems to be able to, there seems to be more order in Zimbabwe than there is in South Africa. And I wonder, is it this neo-colonial, you know, nostalgia, and as a neo-colonial power, South Africa is sort of that it's fading. Our power as a country is fading. Yes, we have resources, but because of how the ANC has handled everything, that power is fading. And I'm curious as to whether some of these foreign policy moves are informed by nostalgia, if we may call it that, like some neo-colonial nostalgia, or some, you know, are we in denial of South Africa's fading stature, if I may say that. Ramaphosa is trying to put out the fires of a failing power, basically. I don't know if you could speak more on that.
Yeah, I think South Africa is regarded superficially, of course, as a superpower in the African continent. We are known to be a country that has resources, a country that has a functioning democracy. But unfortunately, that's the image we have from a distance. Then when you come to closer, you check our military, the working conditions of soldiers, their treatment, the social divisions of labor, decision-making structures there, you realize that actually this country is on the brink of collapse. But since we also have African agreements with agreements and partnership within African states, South Africa is sort of forced to pick this type of a decision, because if there's a crisis that has a potential of affecting different countries, South Africa has to put a hand as well. I don't think it's an isolated issue, isolated to South Africa. So based on that and the existing agreements that involve the deployment of military, the supply of aid, so on and so forth, we are just obligated by our international partnerships. But in terms of looking at our capacity, do we have a capacity for that? We don't. But because we are bounded by those international partnerships, we end up having to send soldiers who are not even prepared for such commitment. The same issue as the World Health Organization regulations and requirements, where they say that if someone comes to your country, whether illegal or legally, you cannot deny them healthcare. They can't go to a hospital and you say, no, you are a foreigner, go home. You have to give them care. And I think those are the dynamics of having to have this sort of international partnerships that we did not really understand. How are they in line with our own local ambitions?
If you stood before a ruling party official and charged South Africa with being a failed state, you would quickly be corrected. Like ruling elites anywhere in the world, the men and women who run the country don't see failure. And why would they? It is not their children who have to attend classes under trees, or their elderly parents who die in the hallways of hospitals waiting for care. But how much of this failure or denial of failure is tied to South Africa's diminishing influence as a regional power, or what some political analysts have called neocolonial nostalgia?
I've been saying this for a while. I think for over a decade now, South Africa is a, if not a failed state, is at least in the process of failing, because by the numbers, right? By the numbers, I'm not saying maybe there is a reality on the ground that's different, because people do say that we are overly obsessed with statistics. But by the numbers, South Africa looks like a failing state. I mean, just recently, the police minister, Bekicele, released the crime stats, and we recorded 7,000 murders. And mind you, we've never, I think for the past 4 or 5 quarters, we have not, those numbers have not went beyond 5,000. So I'm curious as to, is it fair to say we are in the process of failure as a country? And
it's a fair assessment. It's a fair assessment in the sense that since 1994, there's never been any ideological work done to transform the country. The issue has been on the social wage and the redistribution of resources. So there's never been a time when the government and its state organs reflected on what sort of a country do we need and how do we craft a vision for this country. That has not been there. All we did is to, we inherited some of the infrastructures from the apartheid regime. Some of them have collapsed them. If you check the healthcare system, check the hospitals that were inherited from apartheid, some of them were collapsed. The roads, the same thing. There's been issues with the management of road infrastructure in South Africa. The railways, the same issue. So we are not growing as a country based on issues of mismanagement of resources, corruption, and maladministration. On top of that, we also have a problem of racial capitalism, that maladministration and corruption does not necessarily affect white people directly. It affects Africans, more importantly, because those are the ones that occupy the lowest rank of race in South Africa. And because of all these situations, we have kind of reached the level of structural inertia in which the conditions, the way they are likely not to change, because South Africa is not coming up with policies that are more responsive to our immediate social, cultural, and economic problems. All they've been doing since 1994 is to copy and to do a cut and paste of policies from foreign countries. And when they bring them here, the policies are not working. And one of the issues is this, the embracement of neoliberalism as our economic framework. It hasn't worked. That everything else that we try to do is then swallowed in the logic of the market. Even now, the state is referring to citizens as clients, as customers, and it shows that actually we are on the brink of collapse through all these various issues. And we also have another dimension that we don't talk about, South Africa has a corrupt democracy. So there's a mismatch between neoliberalism and democracy. Democracy says this is a country that should benefit everyone else. Neoliberalism says, no, this country is for the elite. So now the democratic tools and mechanisms have actually been co-opted into supporting neoliberalism. So that we are a democratic society has really been abused to silence people that they shouldn't talk about inequality because everybody else is free. But when you look at actually practically what's really happening in this country, there's a sense that democracy has replaced apartheid. And actually, that's a false narrative. Actually, what we've seen apartheid reproducing itself through neoliberalism, the way that it denies the existence of race, whereas it depends on racial exploitation to enrich capital.
So I wanted to talk a bit about what then does that mean for the region, right? Let's Southern Africa is a region. If South Africa is failing, as we say, what does it mean for the region? And maybe also, I'm thinking of Eswatini, right? And I was hoping maybe you could touch a bit on that as well as an example of this. You know, I remember a while back, someone said South Africa is a poor man's neo-colonial power, right? And you were speaking about South Africa's inability to sort of to intervene or say something about what's happening in Eswatini. So I'm just wondering, what does that mean for the region? Does it mean it's each man for themselves, or what does it mean for the region, for Southern African region, for the Southern African region? Is there hope for a different trajectory, I guess?
I think South Africa is a vehicle for development in Africa. So in terms of many people moving around through the continent, coming to South Africa as their stations. So we're just a good vehicle for development. And some people can come to South Africa, do some work, do some businesses. But South Africa is never a leader of the continent. And I think we need to make that distinction, that given the leadership of the ANC that has failed to deal with small local issues, you can't expect the ANC government to be the leader of the continent or the region. They have no such capacity. And unfortunately, then inherited a country that has been colonizing other African states during colonialism and apartheid, because South Africa had played an important role in terms of expanding white supremacy on the continent. So the ANC kind of inherited that. But theirs now, it's not firstly a civilizing mission. They can't even set a political agenda. So South Africa has just found itself in having this cultural significance as a superpower in Africa. But at the moment, the type of the leadership we have doesn't permit that. And worse, all these African states are depending on neoliberal policies. The difference is just slight mechanisms in terms of implementation. In South Africa, we have full-blown neoliberalism. When you go to Botswana, you see some element of state intervention, which is lacking in South Africa. So South Africa can't be a leader of the region, given those challenges that Anglo Platinum is able to do business with the state in Botswana peacefully. But when South Africa is enforcing the same policy here in South Africa, Anglo Platinum says, no, we can't. We don't want the state to be intervening in the mining sector.
South African TV screens and social media accounts are covered with colorful images from political rallies as campaigning is in full swing across the country. But beyond Israel's assault on Gaza, what will be some of the defining issues of these elections?
Ramaphosa announced that on the 29th of May this year, the country is going to elections. How do you see it? I see an oversaturation of liberal parties. Like, I'm yet to, right? There seems to be all these new parties. There seems to be a belief that we can somehow return the country to wherever these, some of these parties believe the country was at. I haven't had any radical ideas as to how do we address, inequality in particular. So is there hope? Will the ANC be unset? Will it lose power? Will it go under 50%, as people have suggested? Or are we being overly optimistic? It might just win and we go back to normal. And this has happened before. Many parties have come.
Yeah. I think many people are over ambitious. Mm. They are expecting that the ANC is going to get less than 50%. It's impossible. South Africa has a huge number of sentimental voters. People who align themselves with the ANC just because it's the ANC.
And they come out
for them voting. Yes, voting for them means voting for the ANC. Mm. If you tell them that, no, don't vote for the ANC, they'll rather stay at home. My mother is such an individual that is either voting for the ANC or no vote at all. So there's been a saturation of liberal political parties, as you say. And I think that's the danger of democracy, where everybody else wants to lead, but they don't really understand the fundamental problems that are affecting this country. Because most of this country, political parties are saying, we have an issue of corruption, we have an issue of incompetence, we have issues of maladministration. That's their diagnosis. And I can assure you that South Africa can even fight corruption, but inequality is going to remain because the South African economic system is structured in the way that it benefits big corporations. It benefits the elite, whether political or non-political. And I think the EFF has been able to make such a correct diagnosis that we have the problem of racial capitalism. And even in that context, it's still going to be difficult for any political party that comes to government with left-wing ambitions, because capitalism in South Africa is so much entrenched. If anybody else wishes to dislodge that, it's going to require a lot of effort, maybe up to 15 years, because the way the ANC has been depending on corporations, it's shocking. In South Africa, corporations even have a hand on the type of legislations we have. So if you are saying, let's go to more a full-blown radical left-wing political ideas, it means that you're going to have a lot of work to do.
So it's fair to say we might, if there was ever to be sort of political change, we might be a Venezuela, because I think that's what similarly happened to Venezuela, right? When Chavez tried to, when he nationalized some of the state resources suddenly. So there are people who are saying if anything was to ever happen, we would be that country. Basically, would be a Venezuela.
It's a risk worth taking, because we are here at the level of structural inertia. Things are not changing. The same people who have been poor in 1994 are still the same people that are poor today. The same people that have been rich since then are still the same people that are rich today. The strategic sectors of the economy are still in the hands of white people, with few black elite that are being put in, integrated into that economic system just to give us a false sense of unity and integration. So I think South Africa does need a black radical socialist economy that is going to prioritize the living conditions of black people unashamedly. Unfortunately, with the current ANC government, the ANC is even scared to mention the word black, because they know that if they say, no, we are for black people, the funders are going to withdraw the money. So we do need somebody who speaks for black people decisively, for the mere fact that South Africa does not have a black government. What we see is a non-white liberal government that has been in bed with white capital. And since 1994, things have been the same. So many people have been wondering, is the ANC in office or in power? The answer is, these people are in office. They are managing a white economy, which cannot translate its benefits into ordinary black South Africans in the form of Africans.
So it's a dead end. It might be a dead end, basically. It might be a dead end. So what is just quickly before we end, what is one issue that you think is going to define elections? For me, it seems to be migration. I know we don't have time, but for me, it's migration, right? Which links to what we're talking about earlier, nationalism. I don't know, unless there's another issue. I would say gender-based violence, but I see that migration is very hot. It's a hot issue.
Yes, I think that is going to eat the EFF's vote. When you look at the level of tribalism in South Africa and you expand that into xenophobia, South Africans are tribalistic and they are xenophobic. And if they are struggling and you tell them that people must come to Africa to do business, then it has some inconsistencies. And let me explain further. If the EFF wants everybody else to be welcome in Africa, Black Africans must come to South Africa, that's a good ideal. But it can't be South Africa's responsibility to do that. Because we need to first deal with the concept of a nation state. We can't accept the concept of a nation state that comes with its own rules and regulation, migration rules, and say, we agree that we're a nation state in the form of South Africa, but we will still allow everybody else to come here. It doesn't work like that. If we want Nigerians, Zimbabweans to come to South Africa freely, let South Africans also have the privilege to go to Kenya to study a spaza shop without harassment. But that has not been reciprocated, and I think that's what's going to eat the EFF's vote. For the ANC, the MK party is going to leave a big dent on the ANC, because the ANC has some undecided voters. So those that are aligned with Zuma will definitely leave the ANC to join MK. But there's also another issue. South Africa over-exaggerates the influence of Jacob Zuma. The man is not powerful. The man has lost power and he's finished.
The man
but
is old.
Yes.
He should be
he's finished.
Retirement.
And people are thinking now this is the man to look for. No, I don't think he's going to bring any. So I don't even think that the party will be able to launch its manifesto. But we see this person and the MK as this powerful figure who's going to frustrate the ANC. The dent is going to be there, but I do not think that this is someone who should send shivers down the spines of many South Africans.
Thank you so much to Dr. Meiji Makoba for generously sharing his insights with us, and to you as the listener for joining us on Ufahamo Africa. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwu Funanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, Harry Stoltz, and Macheri Muguero. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Ami Tamaklo, Fu Asedu, Xbidi Olugu, Basil Ibrahim, and Hopalong Bokulkane. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.